I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason. And this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, we're back for episode 106. Is that the right way to say it, Ron?
106.
106?
Mm-hmm.
Not 106?
The and is read as a decimal point sometimes.
Okay, yeah. I remember you said that before. So 106.
So you could, if you had like a temperature of 106, then maybe you should stay in bed. You have the flu.
Oh. Okay.
If you have a temperature of 106... Then you're probably dead.
Then you go to the hospital, yes.
Yeah. Works. All right, so episode 106, and with that, let's have a disclaimer on.
I am an employee of Wizards of the Coast, and my employees are mine and not theirs.
Well, your employees, what about your opinions?
My opinions? That's what I mean. I am an employee of Wizards of the Coast, and my opinions are mine and not theirs.
Excellent, excellent. I was worried that you were you had a separate company going that Wizards didn't know about.
And wow, oh,
that could
wow,
be trouble.
Wow. Yeah, well, you own your you have your own, your opinions are yours, so they're your employees, right? You put them to work here.
Oh boy, do I!
All right, nice try for the segue. Yeah, good answer, good answer. Okay, all right. So this past week, we're going to just jump right into a topic here.
Sure.
This past week, this past Tuesday, we had our session zero with Jason.
That's right.
Of Scum and Villainy.
Scum and yes. Or Villainy.
Yes.
And. It'll be and.
Oh, okay.
It'll yes. Be and Villainy.
It'll scum be both. You're promising me Scum and Villainy in this economy?
Exactly. Look, I'm a GM. I will promise the world. Or worlds, excellent. As the case may be, because it's going to be in space.
Sweet.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. I just sort of went through explaining the rules, but also everyone made their characters, or at least, you know, got the basics down. And you all decided who you wanted to be as a crew, as a starship crew. And it turns out the Intrepid Scoundrels are going to be a bunch of smugglers out on the outer
rim. Spoilers. No spoilers that were given.
Wait, being smugglers is a spoiler?
For our I don't know how much, because we're going to talk about this in our podcast, right? We've recorded
sure,
this
yes.
in the show. Okay.
Oh, okay.
That's true. Well, like, well, how are we going to talk about the
spoiler
characters?
Alert then. So if you're going to listen okay. to session zero yeah. of Intrepid Scoundrels now. Ooh, should Intrepid I change scoundrels? That? Should I change that?
I think you should. That would I think be awesome. You guys should be. Yeah. I'm going to be calling
also
it that.
A class, though.
Do we have a? Do we have somebody that's using the Scoundrel playbook? Playbook is what they're
yes,
called,
it's,
right?
It's John. Yeah, playbook.
That's me.
Yeah. John is, yeah. Okay.
I was surprised to find that playbook is a fairly universal term in a lot mm-hmm. of light indie RPGs. And I'd only just come across it when you're just talking, when we did the slot zero for yeah. Scum and Villainy, but what playbook replaces class in a lot of indie RPGs, especially ones where they're light enough to put all the rules that you need for that class on like a single page or front and back of a page yeah. or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, and a lot of the times, I think the sort of like the, if you want to get like into the real fine tune, what I think the difference is, a class is sort of in a lot of ways, a linear progression. Like it shows you when you get this at level one, you get this at level two. The classes are intricately tied to levels, right? Because you have, you know, class features at this level, you get this, and there's choices, right? You know, in between all that. But with a playbook, it's kind of open all at once in a lot of ways. You start, mm-hmm. you know, you do some stuff with stats generally, but then there's also like, here's a list of abilities, pick one. And these will be the list of abilities you will pick throughout your career, you know, with some exceptions, of course. But then, you know, there's some other things that you would like, might check this one off, might check this off. And it's all, yeah, like you said, fits there nicely. All the rules of each of those are just smack dab in on the sheet. And I think the word playbook is maybe more of a, gives it more of an open feel. I'm not sure, but you know, Powered by the Apocalypse, lots of Blades games, other indie stuff. Yeah. Lots of, use that word a lot.
What's yeah, your you know, Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it certainly is an open field when I was looking at it, because I'm like, oh, I can get all these. I have all these abilities. I have a full menu of abilities and I can pick any of them that I want. And once I get another one, I will be able to pick any of the others that I want. So I see your point, Jason. It's very unlike a class where you're like, well, I see this cool, you know, I get to do divine intervention only when my cleric level is 10 and there's no way I can do it before then. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And what it reminded me of is when you think about like sports plays, like football plays, basketball plays, where they have things, here's the things that we can do. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to wait until, oh, we've been playing for 10 years. Now we're going to do this thing, right? We can pick and choose. And some of them build upon each other. Some of them are kind of like maybe, you know, antithetical to each other, right? They're completely the opposite, but they all have different reasons for doing it, you know? Mm-hmm.
And quite often in these games, and it's the case of Scum and Villainy, one playbook per player. You know, you can play, you know, D&D, Pathfinder, whatever, and it's something that people do, like, let's all be bards, let's all be clerics or whatever, and you can do that, and also, you know, because of the way that the certain things will obviously be the same, but then there's other choices you can make with ancestry and feats and stuff like that, weapon use, and, you know, that sort of make it different, but these types of games don't get into that granularity. So it's sort of like, if you're picking someone's the stitch, it really helps the niche protection of your playbook, of your character, to be like, hey, I'm the pilot, I'm gonna be the best at piloting, I will have things that let me be better at piloting than anyone who even makes their piloting skill, their helm skill, you know, better than mine, because I will have be able to break the rules and X, Y, and Z. It really helps. This is a bit of a tangent. A couple years ago, I decided that I would like, I read The Forbidden Spark, I read through Scum and Villainy, and I was like, I'm just going to write one of these. And I have about like, it's playable. It's a playable, weird Western version. And then there's probably like three or four of them already, at least out there that exist. But I have my own thing, and I did it, you know, and I could sit down and like make playbooks, decide what the niche is, and then go ahead and write abilities for that help that niche protection, and that can play in that space in a way that's just sort of like, not to tell you easier than designing a class, but you know, a little bit.
I want to drill down on how you did that. Is this, when you're doing niche protection, when you're setting up a playbooks where some of them, one of them has a thing that none of the rest of them can do, do you move from the concept that you have to abilities, or do you have, here's a bunch of abilities I'd like to see that you then kind of slot into individual playbooks? I'm interested in that component of your design process for this.
No, that was definitely a playbook niche first, you know, looking for, and there's some things that are like, you know, ideas that are going to be sort of maybe semi-universal. You got to have a doctor, you know, the doctor character. It works in a, you know, a science fiction type setting, but it also works in that Western setting where you come in and you patch people up, and then like, oh, then what can they do? And, you know, you can easily, like, because I was writing this mainly for myself, I can borrow liberally from things that are in, just sort of like copy paste some stuff right over. But I was like, okay, you need to have like a full on gunslinger type, you know, that's the one outlaw, but the one who's like the sneaky, the low down varmint kind of, you know, type characters, ambushes. I'm trying to remember the other ones. Definitely someone who's just like in tune with ghosts, the preacher type, right? A straight up, you know, smooth talking type, you know. And granted, now, and a lot of these games too, a lot of the Powered by the Apocalypse, sorry, Forged in the Dark games is what they're called when they use the Blades in the Dark system. Have a thing where you can go take what is called a veteran advance, which is grab another move from another playbook, and that you can have that. And essentially this sort of like does sort of maybe possibly break the niche protection, but allows you to sort of essentially multi-class in a lot of ways. Oh, like maybe you don't have enough people. You can just be like, hey, look, I'm going to sneak and get this move because I need to be the smooth talker and the gunslinger because we only have like three players or whatever.
but that costs more. I thought, aren't there three triangles in front of the veteran on?
Yeah. It does cost a lot more. You have to like save up to get it, and you can't get it right. You can't. It's not the first thing you can buy, and you really kind of have to like. Honestly, that's the sort of thing where you want to check. If you have a big group, don't do that because you'll be really honing in on each other's niches. But otherwise, you know, it's just sort of like it requires a little more expenditure of stuff because it does. It's breaking you out of what you are and making you a more complex class, more complex character. But it can get in someone else's way, essentially, you know.
I see. Yeah, it's funny that a lot of games that have like dabbling in other classes make it a steeper cost. You've got to either have a particularly high ability score to be able to do it, or you've got to take it in place of a class feat, like for Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a near universal thought that if you're going to have a niche that you're in, it will be of a higher cost to get something outside of that niche.
In a way to like make you, not only make you, but sort of suggest that you remain in your niche so that other people can be in their niches and take the spotlight when they need to, and not necessarily you trying to get everybody's eat off everyone else's plate, you know?
Right.
What I've found with the game development and the player creation there in the session zero was that it was relatively straightforward and quick. I mean, in a 1 hour session, roughly, you know, we were able to go through and create all our characters, figure out what niches we were going to be, what abilities we want, how many dots we're going to put in each ability area, I guess. Mm-hmm. Come up with what type of starship we wanted to have, what type of campaign we wanted to get involved in, understand how the decision rules worked for every challenge situation. Just really fast startup on something like this. I was talking to Mark about this, one of our friends who was there, and he really enjoyed it, and I did as well. We were talking how we're really looking forward to this. We think it's going to be really, really cool.
All right. Pressure's on for me then.
Yes, it's really, really pushing cool. That bar up. Expectation.
Yeah, there, a lot of these games have that sort of quick, more quick character creation in a lot of ways. But I mean, once you get to be a steady hand at D&D or Pathfinder, you can make characters very, very fast.
Right, for sure. But you were just learning a new system. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Learning a new system, you just make a couple choices essentially. Like, you know, what playbook? Pick some skills. Pick an ability. You're pretty much done. I did alight over a little bit of some of the stuff that you would have picked, but that's fine.
Ron, you were going to say something as well, or?
Oh no, Jason covered it very well, actually.
Oh, okay, cool.
But Ron, did you? I mean, this is, I guess, a little bit of a spoiler, but you did have to leave a little earlier, and we did make a couple other. I think we stopped recording at that point, but we did make a couple choices outside of the recording about the spaceship because that is a thing that this kind of game does. That a lot of Blades games do. You make individual characters, then you make a sort of character sheet for your gang, or in this case the spaceship, the starship. And you know, we sort of made some, what is it, does it have smuggling compartments, does it have better engines, you know, there's the, you know, it's like it's got a whole sheet, which is pretty, it's been fun. And there's that one in a weird way is more complex than making a character, because there's like,
yes, I thought,
a big
so.
Huge yeah. menu of things here, like, oh, you get two modules, well, great, you can pick like from these 50 you know,
okay.
You know, for like things for your engine, things for that, and they're all sort of like lots of little minor things, a lot of sort of narrative things. But like, you know, it's always like the starship that you started with starts with a galley, which gives you the option to sort of be like, oh, let's pick this upgrade that basically says now everyone can blow off stress by eating a meal together because you have this galley. And that's kind of fun. But, you know, but it definitely flavors the sort of group that you're in. You can also not take that, and we're just sort of, you know, we don't necessarily worry about you having that sort of meal scenes together. You just kind of glide over the fact that you eat every once in a while, right? But more importantly, we, you know, there's other things that are more important to the group. That's like, oh no, we should have better engines, or we should have this trick thing that does. I won't spoil what you all pick, which because you'll see soon enough. We can tell Ron later, but you know, this is important. Okay, that is important to you for the spaceship. That means that, you know, in a weird way, it's sort of like, okay, now I know what challenges are going to be trivial for you, essentially.
I think that's and one of the advantages of me coming into this from such a position of unfamiliarity, right, is that from my perspective, it hardly matters whether we picked galley and that we recover stress over eating a meal together as one of the selections we've made, or whether that's actually just a rule of the game, right? I don't know. Maybe in every single Scum and Villainy, you know, eating together with your crewmates allows you to recover a little bit. I mean, I'm going to know when I see the sort of the you know, group ship character sheet. But as far as the learning goes, you know, that's just how it's going to be. I'm totally fine with that. And then I'll work around that as far as the narrative goes.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. I'm excited.
So, yeah, I'm pretty excited as well. And I don't want to get too much into the session zero. I think it's pretty cool. One of the things I will say is that, you know, we're bringing in a crew of five. And just this past weekend, Ron and I spoke with somebody else that we both know, actually that all three of us know. And he mentioned how he was a big fan of the Blades in the Dark system, had bought into it years ago and never had a chance to play. So I was going to ask you, Jason, if you thought, if it was okay with the rest of the crew, and we've already talked with some of them, but not everyone, would it be okay to add a sixth member to our crew?
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as everyone, again, is cool with it, because, you know, having a little more, having these extra, an extra player will probably be a little bit of, like, not necessarily 100%, like, spotlight time is going to be that smaller, but, you know, just from keeping track of everybody and who what's going on is going to be a little trickier, but I've run this type of game for seven people before, so I think I'm a dab hand at shifting the spotlight onto people and getting stories told that kind of let everyone play around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and also,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm gonna go. So, and kind of given that the rest of the players have kind of made some decisions, if the new player comes in, they'll have like limited roles. I think.
Yes.
What are the two roles that are available now?
I think the two roles that are currently available, and this by process of elimination, is the Mystic and the Speaker. So okay. The sort of the one that does the force stuff, essentially, right? The off-brand force stuff, and the one that is the real face of the one who has the sort of legitimate business, maybe on the ship and works with the scoundrels to legitimize the whole affair.
Mm-hmm. So, so if the player wants to come in, they'll have to prepare one of those. And they had mentioned they'd overheard us talking about it on our podcast. And so I'm hoping that they'll be listening to this and they'll say, okay, I got to make one of those. And then, they got to be all set. So come session one, they're caught up with everybody else's.
Right. Yeah. And if you check with, you know, the other members of the group and they're cool with it, just sort of let me know. And then maybe you and me and then the person can have a little quick off sesh meeting.
Sure. Sounds great.
Yep. I was just going to say from a scheduling perspective too, and now this is getting out of the game into like the real people scheduling, because this is something we're going to be tackling over the summer. And summer is a time when people, you know, have vacations or whatever. I think a slightly bigger group gives us some flexibility to play, you know, a player or two down in a way that if we had exactly four people,
right,
one or two people can't play, you might as well not get together. So,
And I mentioned that what the way that these games work is that they're, you know, jobs that you do and then you have downtime between that. And that was my intent to kind of do this, a lot of discrete stories that maybe sort of tell an overarching story, but to sort of have these sort of discrete jobs happen over one or two sessions of the podcast, and then but those will record probably over in one night. So if someone does miss out, you won't have that awkward thing where like, well, you're coming in the middle of this adventure, but you know, you just sort of appear, you know, and show up, you know, getting someone in the middle is always sort of a tricky, like, oh, you fly in at the last minute, but you know, hey, Han Solo disappears at one point and then comes back when they're fighting the Death Star, right, just out of nowhere. So It's not out of the realm of genre, for sure.
It had a lot of downtime there.
Yeah, he went off. The player had to go on a little vacation or something. So, yeah.
He had some downtime in Carbonite, too, as well. I guess that could happen.
Well, yeah, that was later on. So. Yeah.
That's like the player whose work schedule keeps shifting. And so they're like, oh, yeah. I'm not going to be able to make the game for the next 3 months. Like, okay, we're going to freeze your character in Carbonite for the
game. I mean, the funny thing is that in Blades of Dark, in Scum and Villain, all these games, there's this what happens when you roll your vice. To clear your stress, you take some time with your vice. You can overindulge by basically doing too well at it. You clear more stress than you actually have taken, and then you have these options to be simply like, oh, you overindulged. Here's the three or four things that happen. One of them is like you get in some kind of trouble, and then I roll on a table and find out what kind of trouble it is. You go into debt a little bit or something like that. But one of them is literally like your character just is gone for a game or two, and maybe you play another character for a little bit, and it's sort of like, okay, yeah, that person is just like literally like maybe like got so drunk that they, you know, they went on this long bender and are just gone, and you don't, you know, and or you do something, you say like, oh, maybe they have to spend, you know, a couple of sessions in the back to tank or something to recover. Yeah. But it's weird. It's just weird. No one I know has ever actually done that in the few games.
Challenge accepted.
Okay, so you want to go and then play another character.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of session zero, I will say this weekend I had the opportunity to listen to five luminaries in the gaming industry talk about how to make an excellent session zero. And I'll say that, Jason, you did very well following those guidelines.
Oh, good.
But Ron, are you familiar with this stuff?
I am, and I'm interested to know who these five luminaries are, because I also spoke about session zeros on a panel, and I wish I'd have gone heard to the people that know it better.
Oh, no, it was you. It was you.
Oh, that's sweet.
Bruce Cordell, Eric Scott, I don't know how to say his last name.
I think DeBee.
There's yourself. Luis Loza and Alexander Pereira, who works at children's hospitals running games, all talked about the importance of session zero at NorwestCon this past weekend, where Ron and I were fortunate enough to go and do things. He was on panels. I played games and watched panels.
Good.
I was on panel. I was on so many panels, I was able to play no games.
No.
Next time I'll have to balance that a little bit better.
But what was interesting is that NorwestCon started to ramp up the gaming panels after kind of a hiatus after several years. And Ron was on 7,
mm-hmm.
which exceeded the max allowed, but he stepped in for somebody who could not make another panel.
Right.
But there were a lot of industry folks from Paizo or formerly from Paizo that were there, which made it kind of cool.
Yeah, and there was a lot of, I mean, one of the people I was, had the honor of sharing a lot of panels with was Jason Nelson, who is so mm-hmm. connected in so many distinct mm-hmm. ways to the gaming industry, right? He's done a lot of writing for Paizo, but is a very prolific third-party publisher. Who has people work for him. He pays out. He's one of the biggest third-party publishers that pays out based on royalties rather than per word amount. And so he's got a very robust contributions to a discussion about what does a freelancer do and how are they reimbursed and what is working with them like. And anyway, it was everybody that I was on a panel with, I thought was very well selected and especially knowledgeable. Jason Nelson was one of those people who, every time I showed up on a panel, like, oh man, that guy's got a lot of direct experience on this to say.
Did you go to the licensing panel? That was
I did.
How did that
sit
go?
In on the panel about licensing? It went very well. You mentioned Alexander at the Session Zero panel, who works at a children's hospital, and just what a good addition to the subject of Session Zeros it was to have his perspective. Similarly, on the licensure panel, one of the panelists who I didn't see on any other panel was an intellectual property attorney.
Oh, wow.
And so was a good person to have on for something like that. I think there was a really good effort made to put people who were experts, but on one specific thing on the one panel where they would be able to contribute quite a lot. So that was an example there. But there was also, that also was the case on one of the panels, which was how to get into gaming for like teens and tweens. The person that was moderating that panel had done that sort of on a, you know, working with a lot of schools and working with a game shop in particular for bringing on people who are younger into the hobby. I'm like, oh, this is exactly the right person for this. So there was quite a lot of that went on a lot of the panels.
Right. Yeah. I was able to sit in on that just for a couple minutes. I poked my head in that as I was actually scouting the room for somebody else who's going in next. So that was cool. You know, I was in one of the panels that you were doing, the one that you were, when you were talking about Jason and explaining about royalties and things. So that was for freelancers interested in, people interested in freelancing for the games and stuff, right? That panel. Yep. But I had to leave about an hour into that. I didn't have to, but then I went to the Building an RPG World panel that had Bruce and Stephen Randy McFarland, I think is his name.
Stephen Randy McFarland,
yeah. And Luis were in there. And that room was packed.
Oh, neat.
It was packed. But one of the most, lots of people there asking questions and things. One of the coolest things was there's a gentleman in there wearing full chainmail, full garb, like real chain and everything. And he's part of a Shakespearean troupe that wants to build a LARP game around Shakespeare and build a world. And so he was at, you know, so he had no idea about games or anything, right? And he's asking questions. So how would we go about doing this kind of thing? And where he's wearing, you know, this full outfit, like he would. That is really cool. You know, I think about games and role-playing games and stuff like that, not thinking about all the other applications, you know, for something like that as well.
Well, there was one of the, you know, I bumped into a friend of ours, Mark Walcott, and he talked about, who was also there, and he talked about some of the panels that he was on. And one of the packed panels that was sort of sci-fi related that he went to was called something like Alternate Monetary Systems, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that one.
I mean, which sounds like it sounds like a great topic, but maybe a little niche topic. And to find out that one was just packed. I think that's kind of interesting. Yeah. Now I'm super curious about what that panel was like. I'm sorry that I missed it. But, you know, NorwestCon next year. So
now they did record some of the panels, and somebody asked me about the Building an RPG World panel, if it was recorded. It wasn't, but the freelancer panel was. The Session Zero panel was, I know for sure. Several others I saw. So hopefully these things are out there. But I'm really excited for the fact that this sci-fi fantasy convention is really bringing back gaming. And that next year, Paizo is going to be a guest of honor. Jason, did you know that?
I did not. No.
Yeah, like publisher guest of honor. It was Clark's World Magazine this year, which is a very high quality sci-fi magazine, right? So they're not fooling around on their guests. They're very very talented. We had like the artist guest of honor they had was Jim Butcher, who couldn't make it at the last minute, Kate Allen Marshall. She writes with her middle name. Who wrote a very twisty sort of thriller book that I just loved. What Lies in the Woods. So it was kind of exciting to see a name of somebody. Look, I know these people. I know what they wrote.
Right, yeah.
I ran into Mike and I didn't know.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had no idea. You know, I was telling him, there's this, he and Jenny were GMing Starfinder 2 there. The demo.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one of the, so I was running games, but I also got to play the Starfinder 2 demo, which I thought was really good. And I actually signed up Mark and then sent Ron to go down there and play, but then they had to take a break due to emergency food. They hadn't eaten all day and it was 4 o'clock and they had to go and do that.
They had to go to the galley with the crew in order to like recover their stress.
Recover some stress.
It's a basic rule of the game.
Yes. But I'm very excited about Starfinder 2 just from the little bit I saw from the demo. You know, we got to see all the character sheets that they've come up with so far. The play test has just gone to the printers.
Yep.
They said we can say that. So that'll be coming out soon. And they also mentioned there should be new playtest demos at Gen Con, so different than what's been run everywhere else. And they said some other new things will probably be coming that haven't been announced.
What was your favorite thing about the demo? What was the thing that kind of like wowed you about the Starfinder 2 demo?
So probably two things I enjoyed the most. And they both had to do with the change of the classes. And I'll be honest, I haven't really kept up with the pretest characters and things. I've been kind of waiting for the whole package to come out and to look at it. But you know, we had somebody playing a Solarian, we had somebody playing the Mystic, somebody playing a soldier, somebody playing the operative envoy. Solarian and Mystic. And the thing I was really impressed about was with the Solarian, it was one cool thing in there was rather than having to be like a solar flare Solarian, a solar weapon Solarian, or solar armor Solarian, you could be all three. You were all three at once, right? Oh. So you had a defensive mechanism you can employ, you had a range mechanism you can employ, and you had a melee weapon you can employ. They were just different actions, different types of buffs. So one person, one character could do all those things. They made it very simple to attune. So you got started in an action, and as part of that action, you began attuning, right? You were attuned. You could start doing stuff if you're photon attuned or graviton attuned. To penalize that, a lot of those abilities had a cycle. They would cycle, which is as soon as you use that ability, so your stellar rush or your solar burst or whatever, then you cycled over to graviton mode. And you had to use a graviton ability to do that. Or there was another ability later on that would allow you to go back at some cost. Nice. So the Solarian seemed much more fleshed out and versatile compared to what we've seen is
Starfinder 1. The attunement comes on almost like a panache. It's you have it or you don't kind of.
Yes, that's the impression.
You're attuned one way or another way. You don't have to build up the right. That makes sense because it was always the fights could sometimes end before the Solarian
Exactly.
That's good.
So I'm really happy with that. And similarly, all the characters kind of had that sort of fleshing out. But then the Mystic in particular has this new thing. It's a vitality pool. So in Starfinder 1, the Mystic has a bond where they can share their own hit points with others. Instead, in Starfinder 2, in the playtest that we did, they have this vitality pool. I think in this case, this third level, it was 22 hit points. And they could just share that out of the pool. And then each certain time period, I think it's each round, the pool regained 4 hit points.
Oh, that's not the Mystic's hit points. It's a separate pool.
Right. It's a separate pool. Share. I had to ask that specifically. So basically, the Mystic is able to do much more healing, right?
Great.
But not a lot of big bulk heals because then it depletes the whole pool.
Right.
But they always have this healing available and they can still do all this other mystical stuff.
That's sounds vaguely like the mech's PowerPoint pool, right? Like where you can I can do little things and then get it back. But if I spend the big thing, I'm going to have to
That's a good point. I like that.
Yeah, that's cute.
They mentioned really trying to build up and emphasize ranged attacks, over melee attacks. And so there's going to be some issues with, obviously, with maps and things, right? You need bigger maps. Yeah. Stuff for longer range, and so they're working on various. They didn't mention anything in particular, but for online on VTTs, it's easier to do. But for in person, if you have a 1,000-yard rifle, well, that's an awful lot of hexes or squares.
Squares, you know, to go shoot across, you're right. Table.
As we saw in Dead Sun's, the Dead Sun's book, where they had that massive map where you couldn't get anything. You know, the huge statue that had fallen down and stuff. Oh, it's crazy. So all the classes had really nice tweaks. Use pretty pretty much straightforward Pathfinder second edition rules. So, you know, since I've been playing more second edition, it was all, you know, how you assist things, you know, your three action economy, in terms of treating wounds, all that kind of stuff. It was just all very straightforward. The only additional skill that's added beyond the Pathfinder skills was computers. Everything else was the same.
Even thievery and occultism.
Hey, you can have occultism in space.
Thievery was there. I think that was the case. That was the only one that was, I don't know. Somebody said that. Somebody had mentioned that. I looked through that and I saw, oh, that's kind of, but yeah. So I'm looking forward to it. I did not know they were going to be running that there. I found out when I got there to run my games that, oh, somebody's going to be running these games. And so when I was supposed to be running a game, Jenny was running a game. I said, oh man, I'm going to miss this one. Then I saw they had signups later that afternoon. So I made sure to get my name on that to do it later in the afternoon. And then when I ran into Mark, I said, oh, they're running the Starfinder demo here. Let me put your name down. So I said, I just told him, I put your name down for 4 o'clock.
I've just committed you to this thing.
Yes. And he said, go enjoy it. Yeah. So, so that was like one of my great experiences on the gaming side outside of panels as well.
It was a little bit interesting to me. I've been at that hotel for a number of PaizoCons, and the emphasis was different because at PaizoCon, there were a lot of small breakout conference rooms. Some of them were for panels, but virtually all of them were for games.
Right.
And at NorwestCon, all of those were for panels of a lot of different kinds, tons of different topics, and they kind of shunted the gaming to an area at the end of a long hall. If you didn't know where to go, you miss it.
Was it at the Double Tree? Wow. Okay. I can picture it.
Yeah. So like all the Cascade and Evergreen rooms were all the panels. So
great.
And then in the far rotunda, and that's where the gaming has been in the past. We'd had no signage, but we had a bigger presence and more people showed up. This year they made a very, I talked to Felicia Nightingale, and they made a very distinct effort to have a lot of signage. So everywhere there was signage. And so we had a lot of walk-in folks, but it took people a while to realize we were there. And so it's not until Saturday and Sunday that they know, oh, I can sign up early, be signed up for a game and know that there's a bunch of games. So like Thursday and Friday, there's like nothing. You know, it was really, really slow. But I look forward to it next year, especially with Paizo is a guest of honor, publisher guest of honor.
What does the publisher guest of honor like get to do, or like, do they just have more big panels specifically for them? Like, what happened this year with the magazine?
I didn't get to go see. I was too busy being on panels.
But they had panels. Like, they kind of
saw their name around. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. They're just curious.
I think you'll have a chance to tell us afterwards, since you'll be there doing the guest of honor work, right?
I don't know. Maybe we'll see.
I'm curious. When I saw that, I was curious how big of a Paizo presence would be there. So we'll have to. I know neither of you know that. So
this time it seemed like a lot of people in an unofficial capacity. I was there in an unofficial capacity. I think that went really well. I guess tune in for Digital Divination episode 132, I guess. 26
from this. Yeah. Then we'll be able to talk about what happened.
That's right.
Sure, yeah. Ron, I gotta ask. Were you asked to participate, or did you seek someone out and be like, oh, I want to be in like 100 panels? Or what people
Tim Nightingale, who was setting up the gaming track, reached out to me, and I got a sense that I was kind of on a big list of people that he knew who were in the industry. and asked to go. I checked in with my employer. They were fine with me, you know, participating on my own. Obviously, there was Tim was you know, savvy enough to not try to put me on a what secret project is Wizards of the Coast doing next panel, right? It was a lot of sort of very general gaming things. So it was able to, I was able to speak sort of, you know, off the cuff about a lot of things that, you know, were like panels I'd done before, at PaizoCon or other places. But otherwise just sort of, you know, to bask in the glow of the other luminaries that were up on the panel desk with me.
Yeah. Some big names there too. Some, you know, folks that have been around the block.
I had a little bit of like hero worship for Bruce R. Cordell, who's done a lot of games that I really like, and you know, being able to meet him in person was really neat. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah. I thought the panels were very similar to ones that you would have seen at PaizoCon or at Gen Con, you know, with folks talking about similar topics and things. And so I'm hoping this continued presence helps maybe grow things a little bit more, the gaming side a little bit more, and maybe fill some of the gap that we have with no PaizoCon in person in, you know, in May. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground there, some Session Zero and Session Zero panels. So
that's right.
It all ties together.
That was
together.
A good tie, actually.
Yeah. Well, just trying to make
it. I didn't even know that's what that had been on the Session Zero with panel, Ron. That's great.
Yeah.
We'll tell you in advance next time so that, you know.
I know.
You can give your experiences on episode 132.
Sure.
Well, I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason. And this has been Digital Divination.